This podcast is brought to you by the New York Academy of Sciences, the world's smartest network, in partnership with the Grossman School of Medicine at New York University. It was sponsored by Johnson & Johnson.
The field of bioethics has struggled for a long time in trying to manage the challenges posed by neonates, very young children, adolescents in different research contexts. At the same time, we certainly want to do research on problems, disabilities, and opportunities that face young people and newborns. There are many people today who want their children to be involved in research, who hope that they can gain access quickly, particularly when they face dire consequences.
That's Dr. Arthur Kaplan, founding director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the Grossman School of Medicine. From his opening remarks to an online symposium called Ethical Considerations in Research for Pediatric Populations, hosted by the Academy on September 13th and 14th, 2022. It brought together experts from around the world to discuss some of the scientific and ethical complexities of using clinical trials to develop treatments for children. Winston Churchill once famously said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others that have been tried. And it often seems that many in the medical research community feel the same way about clinical trials, that they are both deeply flawed and absolutely necessary. Nowhere do these flaws reveal themselves more than in pediatrics, and these challenges have led to a great many medications that are widely prescribed in children without having been tested in children sufficiently, or even tested in children at all. This is a problem Dr. Steven P. Spielberg has seen throughout his long career. He's a retired clinical pharmacologist who has worked in academic medicine, both pediatrics and pharmacology, the pharmaceutical industry, and at the Food and Drug Administration.
We were always talking about the therapeutic orphan. This term coined by Dr. Harry Schirke back in 1968, to indicate that the vast majority of medicines, including most of the medicines we actually use in children, are not labeled for safe and effective use in that population because the data aren't there.
Here's Dr. Ronald Cohn, president and CEO of the Hospital for Sick Kids in Toronto.
It has been a long neglected area of research. The majority of drugs that we give to children today have never ever been tested in children. So as we think about the next decade, we have finally realized that we can't go on like this, particularly if you think about the context of therapeutic development.
Despite these challenges, though, he and others believe we could be at the beginning of addressing these huge gaps.
We actually have now an unbelievable opportunity to almost like rewrite history. What it's necessary is that we are not just thinking outside the box, but are actually going to challenge certain paradigms.
And many agree that this is not just an opportunity, but an urgency. Here's Dr. Lin Yao, Director of Pediatric and Maternal Health at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
First and foremost, pediatric patients should have access to products that have been appropriately evaluated, and that when you're developing a drug, and that drug is likely to be used in children, that development should include pediatric study.
And here's Dr. Spielberg.
Starting with the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Drugs statement in 1995, where they very explicitly put forth the issue of doing research in an active way in children, stating that it is unethical to deny children appropriate access to existing and new therapeutic agents. And it is all of our responsibilities to support the necessary research to assure that that occurs. So as much as the science and clinical studies were advancing to support new diagnostics and therapeutics, the task of implementation of all of this and the ethical oversight of all of this, quite rightly, should be viewed as an experiment for all of us.
But what is the nature of that experiment? How can we define these challenges and move forward together towards solving them? One of the stickiest and most complex issues here revolves around one of the very bedrock concepts of ethical research, informed consent. No one should participate in a research study without understanding what they are being asked to do, being aware of all the potential risks, and clearly consenting to move forward in spite of those risks. The problem is that children don't have the legal right to make decisions for themselves. And until they've reached a certain age and level of development, they just don't have the ability to really understand what's being asked of them. Here's Dr. Kaplan.
Obviously, the model of research ethics that we built is very heavily dependent upon the choice of people to volunteer to participate in research. At the same time, we don't want to exclude young people and newborns because they themselves haven't yet developed the capacity or are not going to develop the capacity to give informed consent and indicate their autonomous willingness to join into research.
So how can pediatric clinical trials ethically move forward? To Dr. Yao, we first need to make sure that these trials are absolutely necessary and that the research couldn't be successfully conducted in some other way.
I think it's important to remember that if we can obtain the information needed to support the safety and effectiveness of a drug without having to enroll a child, then we are ethically obligated to do so. Children should only be enrolled in a clinical trial if the scientific and or public health objectives cannot be met through enrolling subjects who can provide informed consent personally, that is, adults.
It's an undeniable truth, though, that the physiology of a small child is very different from that of an adult. And so there are times when running clinical trials with children is the only way to make sure that the treatment in question is safe and effective. In these cases, some are wondering if there are ways to rethink our standards of informed consent when it comes to children, accommodating their capabilities without compromising the ethical obligations of the researchers. Here's Dr. Spielberg.
Our views of children and families have changed remarkably. We have come to think about families, about the relationships of children and parents, in the capacity of children in their decision-making based on developmental stages.
People have been working on this issue for a while. Back in 1978, a national commission that had been assembled to look at these questions published a paper in the journal Pediatrics, where they made a set of recommendations about using assent as the standard rather than consent. Here's Dr. Robert Skip Nelson, Senior Director of Pediatric Drug Development at Johnson & Johnson.
And so if you look at their report or you look at our regulations around the issue of assent, there's only really two things that are included in there. One is a statement that assent is you need the child to say yes. In other words, you can't take the absence of dissent to mean that they assent. And then the second is that you can waive assent if they're not capable. But the difficulty is that there's no definition of the elements of assent as there are for consent. And whether you decide someone is not capable of assent or capable of any activity depends upon how you define that activity.
While the definition of what constitutes consent in an adult is much more clearly defined, the work of this commission did lay out some guidelines for what a child's assent might look like, which are still important today.
Bill Bartholomew, who was a pediatric ethicist who had written a report for the National Commission, gave a proposal around what the elements of assent ought to look like. And there were four. He basically said the child should have a developmentally appropriate awareness of why they're being asked to do something. The second is they should have an understanding of what's going to happen to them. You know, not necessarily the risks, but they're going to have a blood test drawn. They should have an understanding of what's going to happen to them. The investigator should have some assessment of how they process this information. And then the final one is they should say yes. They should have an expression of willingness. And I would argue that if you take that approach, there are children as young as 4 or 5 years of age who potentially could be able to give assent within that framework.
There are some missing pieces in that rubric, though.
Two critiques, at least in our current regulatory framework, which is grounded on the National Commission's ethical reflections, is that there's no definition of assent. And so it leaves open to people to make their own definitions. and there's no requirement to respect dissent. So if you have a view of a child's capability needing to, let's say, do risk-benefit, you could potentially waive the assent of a 7 or 8-year-old or a 6-year-old, and they could actually vehemently dissent, and there's no requirement to respect that.
This opens up another area of troubling vagueness. The idea of being able to override a child's dissent makes sense on the surface. Children can be contrarian, to say the least, and health decisions can be difficult to make, particularly where there is discomfort involved, uncertainty in the potential benefit of a therapy, or when the treatment interferes with their regular lives. Here's Dr. David Wendler, senior investigator in the Department of Bioethics at the National Institutes of Health.
He's a kid who had lots of clinical procedures, wasn't worried about them at all. And when we went to get his assent, the investigator said, "It's up to you. You can go down to phlebotomy and have this blood draw." And the kid said, "If I don't go down phlebotomy, can I stay on the floor and play with my friends?" And so he heard that as the choice. He's an 8-year-old. And to tell you the truth, I think it was probably inappropriate to ask that kid for consent, because for an 8-year-old, that's the question almost doesn't make sense, right? We're saying to an 8-year-old, would you rather play with your friends on the floor or go down and have somebody stick a needle in your arm? And even if you're not afraid of needles, he wasn't, didn't bother him at all. But he certainly liked playing basketball with his friends better.
But what is the line there? Say there is a child who is going to be enrolled in a clinical trial which will require them to be subjected to a long-term course of painful treatments with multiple uncomfortable side effects, and that treatment course only has a small chance of improving their condition. If that child says, "No, I don't want to do this anymore," but their parents want to continue because they are clinging to that small chance of improvement, and the researcher wants the child to continue because of their desire to complete the study and therefore potentially help hundreds or thousands of other children, whose wishes should be respected? It's a complicated question. One principle that helps many begin to sort through it is the idea that while a child might be given a helpful treatment against their will, they should not be asked against their will to participate in research that might benefit others but doesn't have direct therapeutic benefit to them. This draws a line between medicine that also collects research data as a secondary function and pure research done for its own sake. Here's Dr. Allison Bateman House from the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU.
There was the creation of a regulatory regime to keep an eye on human subjects research. And they really differentiated between this idea of medical practice, something that you do to a patient for his or her own benefit. It may not be proven necessarily. It could be an experimental intervention, but it is nonetheless being done for the ultimate purpose of trying to help that patient, versus this creation of research, which is intended to come up with generalizable data that can be extrapolated from that individual to others. And we have different rules on how we allow medical practice to happen from how we allow research to happen, even if it's the same intervention.
Here's Dr. Norman Faust, Professor Emeritus of Child Protection and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin.
There's nothing in the regulations that authorize non-therapeutic research on adults without their consent. It's just an inviolable principle. I had the privilege of sitting at a conference at the FDA convened to discuss this issue, and we spent a long time at this conference discussing whether a non-therapeutic brainstem biopsy was okay. That is a rather horrific kind of intrusion with no conceivable benefit for the child. And we had to spend hours getting to closure on it because a substantial number of people in the room thought it was fine and that it met the definition of minimal risk. That is a clear and simple battery in my view.
Here's Nancy Goodman, founder and executive director of Kids v. Cancer.
I think that the reason we need families at the table is because professionals, all of us in whatever our professional environment is, can sometimes sort of forget to step back and look at something from a more ethical perspective.
Underlying all of this is the need for everyone in the medical community, clinicians and researchers alike, to do a better job at communicating with both underage patients and their parents. Both the child and the adult are in a new world, being asked to consider and make choices about things that they don't have the training or experience to really understand. It's of paramount importance that the professionals in the room speak in a way that is thorough, clear, and modulated to the level of the person they're speaking to, so everyone feels informed. Here's Dr. Wendler.
I think first thing that's important is to think about how you involve kids in general. And I think independent of whether or not you're going to get assent, you should explain things to every kid to the extent and in language they can understand. You should see if they have questions and you should answer them. You should see if they're scared, if they have worries, if there are things you can do to relieve their anxiety and their stress. I think it's good clinical care. It's just respect for individuals, and we should be doing that for every kid.
And according to Dr. Victoria A. Miller, Director of Research in the Department of Adolescent Medicine at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, poorly informed, disengaged patients also make poor research subjects.
If I have a kid who's reluctant to participate and they end up enrolling, that's not going to be great data from a science perspective either. They're going to be hard to schedule. They're not going to complete their questionnaires. And that's not good for the study or the science. So there's other reasons also to think about that reluctance.
Here's Dr. Spielberg.
We should not expect our patients and parents and children and the general public to have the expertise in science we have. But we should expect to be able to share that insight in a way that informs how they interact with us and how we can work jointly to improve this. We use big words. We talk to each other in code. I think we need to partner with educators. We need to partner with parents. I think part of the reason that we have been successful in areas where we've been successful is where we have parents knowledgeable about the disease process, working together with us, not asking us to be the top dog in the picture, but asking us to provide the needed information, the needed science, so that they, in fact, can talk to their children, to their families, to their communities. So I think the future has to be one of partnerships.
This kind of partnership between doctors and patients can ideally lead to a situation of mutual trust, sometimes one where the patient or their guardians are more comfortable yielding more of the decision-making to their care team. Because honestly, people, even children, often know what they don't know. And they often want to be able to trust that their doctor is making good choices on their behalf, rather than having to make those choices themselves. Here's Dr. Wendler.
I don't think this is peculiar to kids. So there are data that 20 to 25% of competent American adults prefer that their doctor make clinical decisions for them. And that's okay. So having a claim to make your own decisions isn't an obligation to make them for yourselves. It's that you get to control who makes them and how they're made. And so if you want to defer to somebody else, that's okay.
The bottom line of creating these partnerships, though, is that patients aren't always going to make the choices that their care team would prefer. Doctors have to be prepared to accept that.
My view is you shouldn't ask the kid positively, are you going to be in this research or not, if you're not going to seriously take a no.
This brings up the question of the proper role of persuasion in seeking assent from a child. It's critical for parents and doctors to try to convince children in their care to make good decisions. Eat well, get enough sleep, don't do dangerous things, take your medicine. But when it comes to signing on for a clinical trial, when do they cross the line from persuasion, pointing a young person toward good choices, and into coercion, talking them into doing something that their head and heart are telling them that they shouldn't do? Here's Dr. Yoram Unguru, a pediatric hematologist-oncologist who works at both Mount Sinai Hospital and Johns Hopkins University, followed by Dr. Wendler.
What are the limits of persuasion and who's persuading? Because I persuade, I'll be honest. When I'm being honest with myself, if there's a study that I think has the ability to allow me to better risk stratify a kid so that I can give less toxic chemo, that is a good thing, man. But I may sell it a little bit differently.
And here's Dr. Wendler.
I don't think an initial no is a final no. So if right at the beginning they just say no, I think it would be a mistake to just walk out of the room and say, okay.
And to be sure, there are a lot of very persuasive reasons why someone might want to participate in a clinical trial. They themselves might get better, and they might also help others in a similar position.
Being in a clinical trial is an unusual example of that, where just an average, ordinary 10-year-old who has, for instance, a rare disease can really help contribute to understanding and helping others. And I think a lot of them recognize that, and they often embrace the opportunity to do it.
But the truth is that often kids who might have the ability to be actively involved in decisions about their own care take a step back because they don't feel empowered to do so, because they have to defer to the wishes of their family or their care team. This might be a question of culture or upbringing or personality or any number of other factors. And in the end, their parents or guardians often do have the legal right to make final decisions about their care, with or without their input. Here's Dr. Unguru.
Some kids have great understanding, but they have no role in decision. And oftentimes that's framed within the child's familial position and their culture and who in that family makes decisions and how are those decisions made.
These inherent power dynamics between parents and children can often strongly influence the decisions younger patients make, even when they are nominally the ones deciding. Lauren Gibbs, a patient advocate currently working for Tempus Labs, has SMA, spinal muscular atrophy, and she's been in a clinical trial for a new medication for that condition since she was a teenager. She talked about how her choices at that time may have been different if her parents hadn't been in the room when she made them.
As I've gotten older and I've been in the trial for longer and now I'm like giving consent, of course I'm like by myself in the room. But when it first happened, my parents were in the room with me and walked through that process along with me. I think it would have been different. I think I was in that mindset, like we've discussed already, that my parents meant so much to me and I wanted to please them, but I also wanted to be the future of what would be beneficial for the SMA community as well. So it was in that tricky space, but looking back, it would have been a different experience with my parents out of the room.
For Dr. Unguru, it's powerful and important for a doctor to try to get as close to active assent from his patients as they possibly can, even if the involvement of the patient's family makes it difficult.
And I think it's important that, you know, when I approach this matter, my assumption is I'm going to solicit the assent of the child every time, knowing that's not going to happen. But if that's my starting off point, then that allows me to involve that child and that child's family in a different way than were I not thinking about that.
Here's Dr. Miller.
There's a host of factors I'd be thinking about. One is prior experience with health-related decision-making. So certainly a child with relapsed cancer, regardless of age, is going to be very different and potentially more involved than a new diagnosis, for example. I think current health status is important. So children who aren't feeling well or are experiencing symptoms, they have reported that they want less involvement and, of course, more parental support. And again, looking at what are their preferences for involvement? What do they want to know? How do they want to be involved in the process? I think there is a lot of room for dialogue and teaching and modeling good decision-making and helping kids to have a voice and feel respected. And that lays the groundwork for greater involvement over time and also hopefully a more favorable view of the research process.
There are many issues facing those who want to make our clinical trial system work better for pediatrics. The last one we're going to discuss today is the question of inclusion. Medicines don't work in a vacuum. This is why there's a difference between a new treatment being efficacious, working in a lab, and being actually effective. Something might work beautifully in the test tube, but fall flat when given to real patients in the real world. This is why we have clinical trials to begin with. Some of the things that can change how well a treatment works are in the differences between different patients who have the same disease. Two people of the same age with the same diagnosis might have very different results based on differences in their personal genetics, or environmental factors like what they eat, the quality of air they breathe and water they drink, the climate they live in, and a thousand other things. This is why, if we want to make sure a new medicine is safe and effective for a wide variety of people, it really needs to be tested in a wide variety of people also. Unfortunately, that is often not done. Here's Dr. Michael Cabana, professor of pediatrics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and chair of the Committee on Pediatric Research for the American Academy of Pediatrics.
The United States is a diverse population, and the leading edge of the diversity, we're going to see it in kids first before we see it in adults. So to develop clinical trials that recruit kids that really reflect the population of the United States is tricky.
The truth is that the children who participate in clinical trials are disproportionately white, wealthy, and urban. This is because these populations have access to better medical care to begin with, so they're more likely to be made aware of a new study, and also because studies are most often conducted in hospitals and research centers in major urban areas. These often require clinical visits during normal working hours, so they're much less accessible to the children of parents who cannot afford to travel or to regularly take time off work. Here's Dr. Barbara Pahud, a former researcher in academia, now director at Pfizer.
Parents in rural and underserved areas don't have the flexibility that their white, affluent counterparts in a city have. So we have to have the flexibility of saying, open up in weekends, nights, which that means paying the study staff to be available nights and weekends. And all these things, again, come back to cost and the flexibility that we need to have to make it happen. Now, when we do it, they come. It's literally like the movie, if you build it, they will come. They will, they do. But where I have found, at least in my experience, the biggest barriers is convincing ourselves in academia, in industry, to bring those trials, even if they're more expensive, and to bring those procedures and allowable flexibility to bring these trials to areas where it's needed.
Here's Dr. Maria Eva Trent, director of the Division of Adolescent and Young Adult Medicine at Johns Hopkins University Medical Center.
I think that there are things that you have to do to keep vulnerable patients in your research. If you're recruiting a disproportionately number of poor people spend a lot of time waiting in lines and trying to get services. Your study has to be different. It can't be that way. In some ways, you have to ensure that you eliminate the barriers for patients to be successful. So I would say one thing is optimizing the workforce to train people from those communities, if you can, or from diverse communities to participate in research or learn how to do it well. And then the second piece is that I think we have to design research understanding who we want to recruit, and that it's probably unethical for us to continue to design research studies using simplified approaches to recruitment in ways that people can't trust them or in ways that really only benefit and are easy for the scientists.
Improving this access is critical, not just because it will lead to better studies with better data, but because for many, it represents a small part of a larger problem, systematic racism that provides inferior medical care for children of color.
Discrimination really is this differential treatment on the basis of any given social construct that disadvantages a group of individuals, or its treatment on the basis of inadequately justified factors other than that social construct that disadvantages the group. And so people say, how do we know racism affects health? Here's data from Kenneth and Mamie Clark, published in 1947, that was used in the case of Brown versus the Board of Education, that really demonstrated that African-American children were actually internalizing racism because of their exposures. It represents one of the many studies linking racism to health outcomes for patients. It's consistently associated with poor mental health, depression, anxiety, psychological stress, poor general health, and poor physical health. So the data is there. The basic science of pediatrics is where biology, health and development, and the social ecology of the child come together. And the challenge becomes, how do we get discrimination not to be a part of that anymore?
All in all, the overarching theme of this important symposium was this: by keeping these primary concerns in mind, consent, communication, and inclusion, pediatric clinical trials can be improved. And through the work of ethically minded researchers like these, that improvement will come. Here's Dr. Yao.
The future looks very promising indeed for pediatric therapeutics development. We have developed new tools, methodologies, operations, and review strategies to increase the availability of safe and effective therapies for children.
But where do we look to? What's around the corner? What issues demand action and our attention?
And here's Dr. Trent.
We're really seeing our ability to change things because we're being creative and we're designing research studies that work for the people who need to participate in them to make them simulate what people are going to need in real life. We have to act as if it were possible to radically transform the world, and we have to do it all the time. I think our children deserve it.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of the New York Academy of Sciences. All the excerpts you heard today were from presentations given at the event Ethical Considerations for Research in Pediatric Populations, held virtually by the Academy September 13th and 14th, 2022. It was co-presented by the Academy and the New York University Grossman School of Medicine and made possible by the generous support of Johnson & Johnson. I'm your host, David Hoffman, and I co-wrote this episode along with its producer, Tasha A.F. Lemley. Post-production by Alex Brower. Executive producer, Dr. Melanie Brickman-Borchard. Special thanks to all the experts we heard from in this episode, Dr. Arthur Kaplan and Dr. Allison Bateman House of New York University, Dr. Stephen P. Spielberg, Dr. Ronald Cohn of the Hospital for Sick Children, Dr. Lin Yao of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Robert Skip Nelson of Johnson & Johnson, Dr. David Wendler of the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Norman Faust of the University of Wisconsin, Nancy Goodman of Kids v. Cancer, Dr. Victoria A. Miller of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Dr. Yoram Unguru of Mount Sinai and Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Maria Eva Trent of Johns Hopkins University, Lauren Gibbs of Tempest Labs, Dr. Michael Cabana of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and the American Academy of Pediatrics, and Dr. Barbara Pahood of Pfizer. For more information about the New York Academy of Sciences and all its programs, as well as to listen to other podcasts, please visit www.nyas.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast on all of your favorite podcast apps and follow us on social media at NYA Sciences on Twitter and Instagram, or the New York Academy of Sciences on Facebook and LinkedIn. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider becoming a member of the New York Academy of Sciences, the world's smartest network.